From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. Senate confirmation hearings are underway today for Christopher Wray. He's President Trump's appointee for FBI director, and if confirmed, Wray will take the post once held by James Comey, the former FBI director whom Trump fired in May. And the hearings come right in the middle of the maelstrom surrounding revelations of Donald Trump Jr.'s meeting with a Kremlin-linked lawyer during the campaign last year. Last night, Trump Jr. defended himself on Fox News, but said that he, quote, could have handled a meeting with the lawyer better. His father, the president, took to Twitter to stand up for his son, tweeting, quote, my son Donald did a good job last night. He was open, transparent, and innocent. This is the greatest witch hunt in political history. Sad. Well, we're joined now by NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving to give us the latest on what's happening at the Capitol. Hi there, Ron.
Hello, Meghna.
Well, let's start off with Christopher Wray's hearings today. I've got some tape here of Republican Senator Lindsey Graham pressing Wray about his assessment of the appropriateness of Donald Trump Jr.'s actions. And here's a bit of that exchange.
I think it would be wise to let the FBI know.
You're going to be the director of the FBI, pal. So here's what I want you to tell every politician. If you get a call from somebody suggesting that a foreign government wants to help you by disparaging your opponent, tell us all to call the FBI.
To the members of this committee, any threat or effort to interfere with our elections from any nation state or any non-state actor is the kind of thing the FBI would want to know.
Your analysis of that exchange, Ron?
Very carefully worded. Notice that he said to the members of this committee, and those are the people he's addressing in the room. He was very careful to keep it in the room and not sound as though he were sending a message either to the president or any of the president's progeny or any of the president's men or women. He was trying to just answer the question in the context in which it was immediately being asked. And that's the kind of careful, lawyerly response we've been hearing from Chris Wray all morning.
Interesting. But there's context within the context of all that's been going on with the Trump administration. I mean, tell us a little bit more about Christopher Wray himself. What kind of background does he have and what have senators made of it?
He is not what you'd call a household name. He's not as well known as most of his predecessors were. Most of the photographs you will see of him in stories prior to today were taken in 2005 when he was a young but highly ranking attorney in the Justice Department under President George W. Bush. And he got involved in some of the controversies of that time with respect to surveillance and so forth, but he was not damaged by these issues. He has, generally speaking, been assigned to that group of people who were objecting to some of the extremes of surveillance proposals from the Bush administration. And he left later in that same year to return to his private law practice with King & Spalding. That's an Atlanta-based firm that specializes in white-collar defense for individuals and corporations. That has included a couple of Russian corporations, and that has raised some eyebrows in some quarters. But that is not necessarily Chris Wray's direct involvement in his law firm, and that has not been a big focus of these hearings, at least not so far.
Interesting. Well, Democrats today asked Wray several times, and Wray responded that he insisted that he was never asked to give any kind of loyalty oath, as James Comey has claimed President Trump had asked of him. So are responses like that going to satisfy Democratic senators that Wray is going to be an independent FBI director?
They will not fully satisfy every Democratic senator, and they certainly will not satisfy every critic in the media and in the social media that you can see objecting to Chris Wray. But from a practical standpoint, they are likely to be sufficient. We've already heard Democrat Dianne Feinstein of California say that she is accepting Chris Wray's representations in this area. And so that would seem to be a pretty good signal.
Ron, just a couple of quick seconds there, here. Healthcare, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has pushed back that August recess by a couple of weeks. Are they still far from a deal, though? Just got a couple seconds.
Yes, they are more than 2 weeks' worth of negotiation away. They need a breakthrough. They need a magic bridge to bring together the different parts of the Republican Party. It's not in sight yet.
NPR Senior Washington Editor Ron Elving. Ron, a pleasure as always.
Thank you, Meghna.
Well, as the Donald Trump Jr. story unfolded over the last few days, culminating in his admission that he met with what he was told was a Russian government lawyer who would have Russian government documents incriminating Hillary Clinton as part of a Russian government plan to back his dad, we constantly heard from some of our listeners, well, what about Hillary Clinton and Ukraine? They're referring to a story first published by Politico in January, detailing an effort by a Ukrainian-American consultant who did research with Ukrainian embassy officials and gave negative information about Donald Trump and Paul Manafort to the Democratic National Committee and might have tried to give it to the Clinton campaign. Kenneth Vogel co-authored the story with David Stern. Ken's now with the New York Times and joins us at his desk phone. Ken, this research was being done by consultant Alexandra Chalupa because Paul Manafort, also a consultant, had advised the despised Russian-backed former president of Ukraine, Yanukovych. This is why she was initially researching Manafort, right?
Yeah, that was certainly the means through which she thought she could help the Clinton campaign and the Democratic National Committee. But the broader context here is that the Ukrainians, including Ukrainian-Americans, were worried that if Donald Trump won, he would saddle up to Russia in a way that would put Ukraine in a bad position. Ukraine and Russia obviously being geopolitical foes, and Ukraine has counted on the support of the U.S. in the past in its dealings with Russia, and there was some fear in the Ukrainian-American community and in Ukraine that that would change if Trump, who was saying very nice things about Russia and Putin, were elected.
And let's just remind ourselves, both Yanukovych, the former Russian-backed president, and his advisor, Manafort, were despised by anti-Russian Ukrainians because Yanukovych withdrew Ukraine from the EU, signed that deal with Russia instead just before Putin invaded and seized Crimea. And so she had been studying Manafort and predicting that he'd be picked by Trump to be his campaign manager. When he was, her star rose. But do we know that she actually met with the Clinton campaign, that she actually gave information to them?
Well, we know that she was meeting with the Democratic National Committee, for whom she was working as a consultant, and we know from WikiLeaks, as well as from supporters of Bernie Sanders, that there was a feeling that the Democratic National Committee, even before the primary was resolved and Hillary Clinton was the nominee, was in the tank, is the term that the Bernie Sanders supporters use for Hillary Clinton. And certainly there were close relationships between Hillary Clinton's campaign and her allies and the Democratic National Committee. And so there was thinking that regardless of who ended up being the nominee, that this information on Paul Manafort could be useful for Democrats and their presidential nominee in trying to cast aspersions on Donald Trump and suggest that there were close ties between his team and pro-Russian forces, including, as you just laid out there, the folks around Viktor Yanukovych.
Right. Well, the DNC has denied that Chalupa was paid for this research. She had another job with them. She was doing it on her own. They've denied they used information. Several embassy officials, Ukrainian embassy officials denied helping her. And as you know, Lawrence Noble, general counsel of the Campaign Legal Center, spoke with the Washington Post's Philip Bump. He says your article did raise some troubling questions about Ukraine's involvement in elections, but the difference is there's not clear evidence of the Clinton campaign coordinating with a foreign national, certainly, or encouraging and accepting their help. And this young woman was Ukrainian-American, while the embassy workers were Ukrainian. And also, Philip Bump himself writes that this shorthand version, you know, Russia helped Trump, so what, because Ukraine helped Clinton. He says it suffers from a collapse of scale because while U.S. intelligence agencies conclude that Putin directed Russia's intervention in the U.S. elections, there's no evidence of a comparable link to Ukraine.
Yeah, I mean, certainly there was a much more, as we write in the story, there was a much more concerted effort, blessed by the highest levels of the Russian government, to sabotage Hillary Clinton's campaign than there was on the other side, the Ukrainian government's efforts to try to sabotage Donald Trump. Now, that said, the type of information that the Ukrainian embassy officials were discussing with this DNC consultant actually did make it into the bloodstream in a way that had a demonstrable effect on the election and on the campaign, at least. That is that Paul Manafort ended up stepping down amid scrutiny of his work for Viktor Yanukovych. we can't say the same thing about the information that this Russian lawyer was suggesting that she may have had and been able to relay to Donald Trump Jr. She was suggesting it dealt with funding for Hillary Clinton's campaign from Russia. None of that stuff ever made it out. So we have to, I think, distinguish between the hacking of emails and the release of the dissemination of these damaging emails through WikiLeaks and what this Russian link lawyer was talking about relaying to Donald Trump Jr.
Wait, so you're saying that Chalupa did have an effect and that Manafort had to step down. Others might say Manafort had to step down because he was advising the despised Russian-backed president of Ukraine, that he shouldn't have been running an American campaign with those ties.
Yeah, but it was the scrutiny of his work which ramped up during the campaign, in large part because officials in Ukraine pushed out that information, and I don't think that we should dismiss the involvement of Ukrainian government officials in that dynamic.
Kenneth Vogel, we'll link you to his Politico article. He's now at the New York Times. Ken, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, and by the way, that information from Ukrainian officials, not the American consultant Chalupa, included a ledger that showed that Paul Manafort was paid over $12 million in cash by a pro-Russian Ukrainian party, something that Manafort has denied.
Tensions continue to rise on the Korean Peninsula, but South Korea's new president, Moon Jae-in, is looking ahead to an opportunity for North and South Korea to work together, the Winter Olympics, which South Korea hosts next year. Moon has invited North Korean teams to compete in the Games and is even considering a joint North-South women's hockey team. Moon may be trying to recapture the spirit of the 2000 Olympics in Sydney, where North and South Korean athletes marched together during the opening ceremony. The crowd gave them a standing ovation.
This is one of the unforgettable moments in sport. Athletes from South Korea and the People's Democratic Republic of Korea together as one.
That was back in 2000. Could sports diplomacy make any difference today as the North continues to escalate its nuclear weapons and missile programs? To help answer that question, we're joined now via Skype by Andre Abrahamian, a fellow at Macquarie University in Australia. And Andre, what do you think President Moon is trying to achieve with these games, diplomatically speaking?
Broadly speaking, Moon Jae-in would like to get back to a program of broad engagement with North Korea. Economically, people-to-people exchanges, and culture and sports also. There was a period where his, I guess you could say, political forefathers during the Sunshine era of the early 2000s and late 1990s really promoted that kind of thing heavily. And I think he'd like to go back to that. Unfortunately, at this point, the North Korean nuclear and missile programs have developed to a degree that they weren't in the early 2000s. And so the international environment is slightly less favorable for him to pursue these kinds of cooperation.
So let me ask you more about that, because just last week, of course, North Korea tested an intercontinental ballistic missile that's capable, apparently, of reaching Alaska. So, I mean, again, given this backdrop that you're talking about in terms of the international community's view of the North right now, how significant or effective could this sports diplomacy be? Could it actually achieve anything?
Well, generally, sports diplomacy can't precede the broader political environment in which it takes place by too much. So it's hard to see it leading a breakthrough on the nuclear missile programs, which also involve a lot more actors, right? It's not just North and South Korea. U.S., China, and to a lesser extent, Russia and Japan are also really deeply involved in this issue. And so sports exchanges are not going to help resolve that in the immediate future. I do think it could lead to some more forms of North-South cooperation that would help in a narrower sense create a better atmosphere on the peninsula. But in terms of solving the broader problems, I don't see it happening.
So I take your point about the limited efficacy of sports diplomacy. But while I have you, I'd love to ask you a couple of questions about economic development, because you're also senior advisor to Chosun Exchange. And that's a nonprofit that trains North Koreans in economic policy and entrepreneurship. And it's that entrepreneurship part I'm interested in, because I wouldn't think, I suppose, conventional wisdom is that there isn't much entrepreneurship going on in North Korea whatsoever. So, I mean, tell us about that.
Yeah, I think that's probably the greatest misunderstanding about North Korea right now. The North Korean economy is far more marketized than most people understand. And even though there isn't a lot of formal structures to protect entrepreneurship, you do get people finding ways to start their own projects, run essentially their own companies, and make their own economic decisions. And understanding that is important because it affects how we think about sanctions and who sanctions will impact and what effect they might have. And it also, perhaps more importantly in the long run, is really affecting how North Koreans think about their place in their country and their roles in society.
Well, tell me more about that, because, I mean, has that changed in recent years? And is there potential there to change it even further?
Yeah, I mean, part of Kim Jong-un's brand really has been a growing economy. People increasingly, especially in Pyongyang, see wealth being created, and they see a climate in which spending money is okay, and spending money on recreation is also okay. And that, in a way, dovetails a little bit with how they see sports now in North Korea. Kim Jong-un's really promoted an active lifestyle and recreational sports as sort of a signal that quality of life is getting better. During his rule, they've built a lot of sports facilities, whether it's tennis courts or basketball courts or skate rinks. And then also, like most countries, sports provides a real sort of rally around the flag expression of patriotism, which is what you'll see at the Olympics and Asian Games and Winter Olympics, too.
So given all this, I'm just curious, what do you think are the most effective or maybe the most effective levers that the international community can use, you know, if the aim is to get North Korea to give up its weapons programs or its accelerating weapons tests? I mean, I heard you say the sports diplomacy isn't going to work. I mean, are there other economic or development levers to consider?
I think that's the question that policymakers in several capitals around the world have been wrestling with now for two decades. What is it that we can offer, especially now at this point, that is would be worth remotely as much as their nuclear and missile programs are in terms of how they see their state security and regime stability? And it's really hard to come up with a good answer to that. I don't see much that we could offer that they would consider worth scrapping their programs at this point.
Hmm. Well, Andre Abrahamian is a senior advisor to Chosun Exchange. He's also a fellow at Macquarie University in Australia. He joined us today via Skype. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, we're looking at lakes this summer, and some are frozen in amber. Here Now's Peter O'Dowd took a trip to the beach at Spring Lake in northern Rhode Island, where one of the few remaining penny arcades in the country is still in operation.
John Bateman sells summer nostalgia a penny at a time. The owner of the Spring Lake Arcade is pounding away at the flippers of the 1960s-era Gottlieb Crosstown pinball machine. The theme is subway commuting, and the train lights on the display are all lit up.
Well, in the 1960s, everything was electromechanical, which means that all of the features were actuated by a switch, which turned on a solenoid, which rang a bell, made a score, reel go, turned on a light, turned off a light, etc.
It's far from the computer games kids play today, but it's also hardly the oldest game here. Bateman's got a skee-ball machine from the 1940s. Yes.
If you're really good at it, if you can get it into the 50 in the old games, the ball would come down and...
Oh, you just did.
And hit a bell.
And even older than that...
This is a strength tester machine.
Oh, boy.
It's a wooden box from the 1920s with a bell inside. If you've got a dime and a little juice in those biceps...
All you have to do is squeeze these together. So I got eight bells.
Okay.
You got eight bells.
Should I test myself now?
I think you really should.
Okay, here we go. So just push,
just
push
squeeze them together slow.
Okay.
Nine bells. So That's actually what we have is a very competitive spirit here.
And we are officially two grown men flexing at a beach arcade. Sadly for the winner, there is no one around to impress. It's been raining all morning, and a lifeguard is raking the sand back and forth on an all-terrain vehicle. The arcade is in a little building, just a few dozen yards from the water. Bateman grew up going to New England beach arcades, and he bought this one in 1989. It's been a fixture at Spring Lake since the 1930s.
As arcades were originally, it's a low-cost entertainment. But in our arcade here, we can entertain people for pennies, nickels, and dimes.
Some of these games are so old, even from the 1920s. Do they break a lot?
They do. It's just a matter of maintaining them. Every year we go through and add a little lubrication here or there.
And it's Bateman who's also the mechanic. He's an engineer by training, so he understands the way the levers and the doodads work. He has to refinish the wood on a rifle in the shooting gallery and eventually replace the 70-year-old ticket dispenser inside the skee-ball machine. All of it is incredibly retro, evocative of a time that is so far from the one we live in today.
It's part of the reason why we keep it here, because it's something that people can't do anywhere else. It's been a penny arcade since 1931, and I'll keep it here as long as possible.
But at a few cents a pop, it's not an easy business to run. Bateman has to keep modern games on one half of the arcade to beef up revenue. He says kids usually don't pay much attention to the antiques until their money starts to run low. But he also says that kids like the old games. And you know, I can see why.
This is called Pepe the Clown. Pepe will dance.
So you're using your fingers to press buttons that make Pepe the Clown, which is like a puppet on strings.
That's right.
And you're making him dance.
We can make him swing, too, see?
Let's see if I can do it.
Go, Pepe. For Here and Now, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
United Airlines is unveiling its new solution to overbooked flights. That problem was made very public back in April when a passenger was violently dragged off a United flight after refusing to be bumped from his seat. Now, this new system, a partnership with an aviation tech startup called Volantino, or Tio, I should say, could also help United make more money. For details, we've got Michael Regan with us. He's senior editor at Bloomberg News. Hi there, Mike.
Hi, Magna.
Okay, so airlines frequently either, you know, their previous solutions were to offer money or vouchers to passengers when they had to get bumped off their flights. What is United's new idea?
Well, like you said, they're trying to reduce that exact practice of involuntary bumping, or basically kicking passengers off of oversold flights. And they're trying to do it in a way that they'll solve this problem a few days in advance rather than at the last minute. So in the new system, United will simply offer to buy out your ticket earlier, up to, say, 5 days in advance.
5 days? So at the same price that you paid for it?
Well, what happens is the airline basically will send you an email newsletter that gives you the option to sign up for potential rewards, like, say, a travel voucher for up to $250, if you are willing to change your itinerary. And apparently you won't be asked to change the dates that you fly on or the airport that you fly out of. Or even your seat preferences, like economy or business class. But it will give you these incentives to switch your itinerary a little bit.
So if instead of going from Chicago to Atlanta, you'd go from Chicago, San Francisco, Atlanta, something like that?
No, it's more like instead of flying out at the 9 a.m. flight, you'll fly out at the noon flight.
Ah, I see.
That sort of thing. The idea is for a little bit of inconvenience, they try to entice you to give that seat to someone who's booking last minute and willing to pay a lot more, basically. So that's kind of how a win for the airline, as well as the people taking these incentives.
Oh, it's presuming the people who take them want them, of course, right? I mean, that's the whole thing. Like, everyone's supposed to get what they want out of here. But I mean, given the terrible incident that happened back in April and the PR crisis that United had after that, I mean, why would customers be interested in this? Especially hearing that this could be profitable. I mean, talk about making lemonade out of lemons, right?
Right. It reminds me of a column a friend of mine used to write for the New York Times called The Frugal Traveler. So if you're a frugal traveler or just a general cheapskate like me, then, you know, these incentives can be pretty enticing. If you don't have a set schedule, say you're going on vacation somewhere, you're not a business traveler who has to be somewhere at a certain time if you're just going on vacation, maybe it's worth $250 to you to fly out a few hours later. And I think airlines in general, credit card companies have found a lot of success with perks like this. Mm-hmm. Millennials, younger customers especially, are very responsive to these types of perks in the credit card world. And I think, you know, United is betting that the same will hold true in the travel world.
So we've just got a couple seconds here, Mike. Do you think other airlines could adopt similar programs?
I think absolutely. Some other airlines already are on board with Volunteo, the startup that is helping United with this. Australia's Tiger Airways will start using it in August, and Alaska Air and Qantas are scheduled to start using it in the fall.
Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Thanks so much, Mike.
Thank you.
Last night, in his exclusive interview on Fox with Donald Trump Jr., Sean Hannity asked Trump Jr. if any sirens went off after he got that email. As you well know by now, the email asked Trump Jr. to a meeting with a Russian government lawyer who had government documents on Hillary Clinton, part of a Russian government plan to support his father. Here's part of Trump Jr.'s response to that question about a siren.
Listen, I think, like I said, in retrospect, I probably would have done things a little differently. Again, this is before the Russia mania. This is before they were building it up in the press. For me, this was opposition research. They had something, you know, maybe concrete evidence to all the stories I'd been hearing about, but they were probably underreported for, you know, years, not just during the campaign. So I think I wanted to hear it out.
And this morning, President Trump tweeted, "My son Donald did a good job last night. He was open, transparent, and innocent. This is the greatest witch hunt in political history. Sad." But it's hard to remember a time when people saw the same story so differently. David Folkenflik, NPR's media correspondent, is here. And David, right to it, your thoughts on last night?
I thought it was a very sympathetic and kid-glove treatment of somebody who is in the middle of the political maelstrom without apparently the political antennae, sophistication, insight or just gut reaction that you might want with somebody who, you know, is so close to the president of the United States and seems to play a role in his political thinking.
I missed follow-ups, you know, to that one that we just heard. I wanted to hear.
Yeah, I missed them too.
Yeah. Well, you know, you wanted to hear, really? Didn't the fact that this was the Russian government give you pause? Or when you were asked weeks later if there was Russian involvement, why did you say that Russian involvement was a lie when you'd seen an email claiming Russian involvement? Now, Hannity said he wanted to ask that he had asked every question he could think of, that he couldn't think of any more. Let's listen to one other exchange.
Did you tell your father anything about this?
No. It was such a nothing. There was nothing to tell. I mean, I wouldn't have even remembered it until you start scouring through the stuff. It was literally just a wasted 20 minutes, which was a shame.
Mm-hmm. All right. So we've got to take a break. We'll come back.
So this was the point, David Folkenflik, where he said again and again, Donald Trump Jr., look, I went expecting to get dirt on Hillary Clinton and she had nothing. What a shame. The world divides. Elsewhere on the program, we had our strategist, the Democrat Angela Rye and the Republican Paris Denard. Paris has the same view, not that it was wrong to take a meeting with an adversary, but that nothing came of it. What a shame. The other half of the world screaming, you're looking at it the wrong way. You know, listeners, some of them get furious that we have him on because he's seeing in their view up is down. But don't we have to hear that point of view?
I mean, you got to be willing to listen to things that contradict with your own thinking, and you have to be willing to hear about what the president of the United States, what his campaign and what his administration is thinking. But when we say the world divides, it doesn't mean it divides into two equally parts, and it doesn't mean that we ascribe equal credibility to what's being said. I mean, there are a couple of really important things to remember here. I mean, Sean Hannity asked, you know, didn't you, you know, was that a time at which you heard sirens going off about when the email, for example, said this is an effort on behalf of the Russian government to help your father's campaign, more or less verbatim. When he said, no, not really, it was, why not? You know, why wouldn't that, regardless of whether or not there was a fever pitch in the media about this or there was public understanding the degree to which the Russians had been trying to hack in and interfere with our elections, why would that not affect you if you're somebody thinking about the civic good of the nation? If this isn't important, if this is a nothing burger and you're just doing it as a favor, why are you pulling in the campaign manager for your father's presidential bid at a time that he's already clinched the nomination? Why are you squandering his time? Why are you wasting the time of Jared Kushner, you know, who, you know, has had a sprawling and had at that time a sprawling real estate fortune.
These are questions you wanted to hear.
Absolutely. Yeah. But was also a key advisor, Jared Kushner was and is, to Donald Trump, the candidate, now Donald Trump, the president of the United States. Why, you know, here's a question. Why should people believe you when you knowingly lied? And I use that word advisedly. When Donald Trump Jr. knowingly lied in late July in an interview with CNN's Jake Tapper, asked explicitly about whether there were contacts between the Trump campaign and Russian figures, he said no, and their lies, referring to Robbie Mook and others affiliated with the Clinton campaign who had raised that very prospect. Well, he knew that that was untrue. He had read the email. He had encouraged the setup of the meeting. The email had first come to him in early June, about 6 weeks earlier, and he repeated effectively those lies. Now, NPR, let's be clear, it's been very careful not to call certain statements that seem at two with truth, shall we say, from the Trump administration and from other political figures, but particularly from the president and his close advisors, has been careful not to call these things lies. In this instance, with the email, with the communication that was clearly laid out that he participated in, there's no way to characterize it as anything else. Sean Hannity, you know, did everything he could to steer him away from the idea that he was contradicting common sense and contradicting the truth with the version that he was presenting there last night.
Well, okay, but with the political divide that we are in, how much power does Sean Hannity and does Fox wield? There have been plenty of articles recently, one last week in the New York Times from Robert Leonard, a news director for the Iowa radio stations KNIA and KRLS. It was titled, "Want to Get Rid of Trump," which, you know, pretty harsh there, but only Fox News can do it. That's the point. In it, he says, right now, Sean Hannity might have more power over an impeachment process than Paul Ryan or Mitch McConnell. Others are saying this is where something might turn, only through Fox News. But it doesn't feel as if, as you said, there's an email showing that somebody purported that there was Russian government involvement, and that's still not a problem. I listened to Fox for 4 hours last night. Nowhere, except for Juan Williams on Fox, was that an issue.
Well, I think you saw a Charles Krauthammer last night, his longtime Fox commentator, a thoughtful and influential conservative columnist, saying basically there was no there until the emails. And then suddenly he had his mind changed. And on Marsh McCallum's program in the early evening, he really went after the idea that this is just all up in the air and contested. You know, he's not saying it's treason, as some of the more extreme critics are claiming. He's not saying anything was illegal, but he's saying simply that there is a there. This is a real scandal and it's fundamental, and that he thinks it needs to be investigated. You know, if you look, there was this almost comical series of revisions that occurred in the online post by the longtime Republican operative Ed Rollins, who's been fairly sympathetic to Trump, but not utterly embracing, but pretty defensive of him. And over the course of the day yesterday, his post that said this was essentially echoing the idea that this was a nothing burger scandal really got relayed over time. And finally, at the end, he concluded in his final revision something like, this isn't going to end well. You know, and he was taking a stance that seemed about 175 degrees from where he was at the start of the day. And I think people are wrestling with this. You're seeing a lot, except from the alt-right diehard defenders of the president, you're seeing far fewer people saying this is all fake news. This is something they have to address, and this is real. And you're right. Sean Hannity, I think, does have more influence over the Trump administration in many ways than people in significant positions on the Hill. Fox News is so central to the president's state of being and state of well-being, his consciousness of where he stands, that I think it insulates him from the knowledge and the recognition that there are other forces at play that may be beyond his control at times. It's a self-reinforcing narrative, I think, that Sean Hannity offers.
Well, it's an umbilical cord that we saw this week. Fox had a backtrack on its claim that former FBI Director James Comey leaked top secret information in his memos about a private meeting. It's something that they reported. They had to take it back. But before they could, while Fox and Friends was still on the air, President Trump took to Twitter to amplify what he heard, writing, James Comey leaked classified information to the media. That is so illegal. Then, of course, Fox had to retract it. This morning, President Trump tweeted out, I have very little time for watching TV. But no, he obviously was watching it and tweeting it. It's a pipeline.
Well, that's an excellent example of it and a very relevant one. One of the key things that you remember is that, you know, Trump takes his cues from things like Hannity and particularly the morning show, which is ostensibly presented as an entertainment show, Fox and Friends. But then he tweets about such things. He makes claims that go beyond what they do, in this case, what they did, particularly once retracted. And then they have to cover what the president has said. So they're now covering as a straight ahead story. President Trump is saying that Jim Comey disclosed classified top secret information, what have you, even if it goes beyond their own facts and particularly once they've had to retract. Right. What an end, a sealed environment that you're seeing there.
NPR media correspondent David Folgenflik. David, thanks as always.
You bet.
Avant-garde classical composer Molly Herron makes some challenging music. It's work that asks the listener to engage and to open up to new ways of making and hearing sound. At Dartmouth College recently, Herron unveiled a new piece played entirely on homemade instruments. Todd Bookman from Here and Now contributor New Hampshire Public Radio reports.
Molly Herron is a Princeton-based composer, 34 years old with long brown hair. She counts everything from Indonesian and Norwegian folk to American roots as an influence. But her own work is harder to categorize.
I would say I'm a minimalist. I don't know. I don't like wake up in the morning and wash my hair and think, I'm a minimalist. But I think I fit pretty squarely into that camp.
Herron thinks deeply about motion, about energy, and the physics of sound. That made her a natural fit for her latest commission. Dartmouth College asked her to produce a piece to celebrate their engineering department's 150th anniversary. She's spent the past few months working with a group of students, exploring and designing musical instruments, but perhaps not ones you'd expect.
So I wanted to show a bunch of just wildly different approaches to making sound with objects, which is all an instrument is. It's just an object that makes sound, which is basically everything around us.
Wood, metal, strings, and plastic. The students under Herron's guidance didn't go for beauty. They went for different.
My name is Joshua Elliott. I'm a second-year engineering grad student.
Elliott's instrument is a take on the musical saw, but he's bolted on a whammy bar. It looks a bit like something you'd slice lunch meat with in the deli section.
I guess the classic thing would be to say, I'm not formally trained in music, so this is pure experimentation. Yeah, I mean, I think it, on some level, it definitely does open up the things that you're willing to look at. I mean, it also means that maybe it's not as likely to actually sound good at the end.
Amy Garapick is in the Brooklyn-based percussion group Teague. She demonstrates how to create resonance from a simple, skinny, 3-foot-long rod of metal.
And if we hold these rods in the middle and use a little bit of rosin, which is what violinists use on their bow, to create friction, we can move our hand along the rod to create this beautiful sound. And we can sustain that sound by moving back and forth, or we can make it really loud.
There are also chimes made of different materials in different diameters. Thin sheets of metal that produce a thunderish rolling sound. Herron used these sounds as raw material for her new 15-minute-long piece performed on Dartmouth's campus. Percussion group Teague played the instruments, and vocalists harmonized over top. The lyrics, simply the names of materials used to make instruments. Herron says the piece draws on more than 40,000 years of musical history, from flutes made of hollow swan bones to carbon fiber and nylon objects. They each produce a sound, and when done right, a feeling.
Carbon, carbon, carbon. bronze steel. Copper, gold, tin, bronze steel, carbon, fiber, nylon, copper, gold, tin, bronze steel.
I think that one of the amazing things about music for me is that oftentimes you can have these really physical experiences when you're listening to something. There was just a rush of energy there, and I felt it in my body, and I felt it felt like I was lifting up or being pushed down. Or, you know, it's music is physical. It's an entirely physical experience.
Beyond the physical, Heron also wants what she calls open ears, a willingness by the listener to give all the sounds around us their due. For Here and Now, I'm Todd Bookman in Concord, New Hampshire.
And this note from the world of literature, the Library of Congress has announced that it will award this year's prize for American fiction, posthumously, to the late author Dennis Johnson. Johnson was an acclaimed novelist and poet. The New York Times this week referred to his almost saintly status as a writer's writer's writer. His works include a story collection, Jesus' Son, which was later adapted as a film, and a Vietnam War novel, Tree of Smoke, which won the National Book Award. The Library of Congress told Johnson privately back in March that he had won the award. "My head's spinning from such great news," he wrote. But Johnson died of cancer in late May at the age of 67 before he could receive it. And so the library is saying that his widow, Cindy Johnson, will accept the prize on his behalf during the National Book Festival in Washington in early September. And of course, his work lives on. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.